Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
Alrighty then, I have to apologize for Saturday. I was in a Zoom meeting pretty much most of the day, working on the 74th West Coast Science Fiction Conference, which is to be held in Tonopah, Nevada in July. And I signed off from that meeting in order to come and do my A Step Farther Out show here on Anon Radio, and then forgot to reset the manage interface to VOIP so that I could actually do that. Oh, well. And I had some, what I thought were some good things to be said, but I guess I'll have to hold them over for next week and hope they haven't gone stale by then. Now, I've been looking at, so I have quite a quantity of old copies of science fiction magazines, and particularly Astounding, now Analog, which is known not only for its science fiction stories, but also for its science articles and science-related articles. And I was looking, for example, I have here the December 1957 number, which has a fascinating article by Isaac Asimov in which he goes and calculates the change in the radioactivity of the Earth over time. It's a fairly long piece, and I don't know that I could get through it in an hour, but it's a pretty good piece, which I'll read a little bit of for you. Starts by saying, "The trouble with writing articles for Astounding is that you get interested in a subject in direct proportion to the amount you write about it, and start finding it difficult to shake free. For instance, almost a year ago, I wanted to write an article about the origin of life. By the time I finished the first draft, I found I had to write an article about the origin of the atmosphere first. Having done that, I find I have just gotten myself in the more deeply. Now I find I must go back even further. After all, there are things about the Earth that are essential to life and that are even more fundamental than the existence of the atmosphere. For instance, the Earth is solid, isn't it? Well, yes, it is. Yet there is one piece of evidence which makes it look as though Earth, at some time in the past, has been liquid. Earth consists, you see, of two portions of radically different chemical composition. At the center of the Earth, like the yolk of an egg, and in roughly the same proportion, lies a core which consists of iron and of substances soluble in iron. About this core lies an outer layer like the white of an egg, made up of silicates and substances which are soluble in silicates. There may be a finished layer in between, made up of iron sulfide. If Earth were liquid at one time, this state of affairs would be quite reasonable. Earth would not have consisted of a single liquid mixture of everything in and on the Earth. It would not, in other words, be a one-phase system. It would be made up of two liquid phases, an iron phase and a liquid phase. maybe silicate phase is what he means anyway. Failure editing. Everything else would dissolve in one phase or the other, or to some extent in both. These two phases would be mutually insoluble, like oil and water. The iron phase is some three times as dense as the silicate phase, so it would settle to the center of the planetary mass. The light silicate phase would rise to the top, like cream in unhomogenized milk, and float on the iron. If the Earth had never been liquid, but had been solid throughout its history, the iron-silicate stratification might still take place, but it would take enormous time and make for a much more complicated situation in general. Just for fun, let's stick with the liquid Earth in the beginning notion and see where that takes us. The first question is whether the idea of a liquid Earth is reasonable at all. The answer to that depends partly on the kind of process that was responsible for forming the Earth. There are two general types of hypotheses concerning the origin of the Earth. One is the creation by solar catastrophe hypothesis. The Sun passed near another star, or collided with one, or had a companion that collided with one, or had a small explosion, nova fashion. In any case, matter was flung out, or pulled out of the Sun, or of a nearby star, and this matter coalesced, cooled down, and became the planets and satellites of today. If this were so, then naturally the Earth, having started as sun-hot gas and having ended as a solid globe of matter, must have passed through a liquid stage. A liquid Earth would then be not only reasonable, it would be an unavoidable necessity. But there's trouble there. Solar catastrophes have gone out of fashion. Not only can the dynamics of the solar system not be explained by solar catastrophes, no matter how many bugger factors are introduced, and some fancy ones have been, but it seems that material shot out of the sun would never coalesce, but would merely expand out and expand and expand and become interstellar matter. The second type of hypothesis, and actually the older of the two, is creation by gradual accumulation. In other words, the universe is considered to have started as a conglomeration of individual atoms. These hit one another, and sometimes stuck together to form tiny solid particles that slowly grow. The mutual gravitation of these particles causes them to break up into turbulent galaxy-sized portions. Within these portions, knots of local concentrations are formed, and out of these grow the stars. There seems good evidence that this sort of star formation has been continuing steadily ever since the universe began, and is in progress today in suitable parts of our own galaxy and of others. As the particles at the center of each particle cloud collect into a mass, the process speeds up autocatalytically because the gravitational field becomes more intense. The kinetic energy of particles falling inward into the growing protostar is converted to heat, and the temperature rises. Eventually, the temperature and internal pressure of the mass of matter gets high enough to start thermonuclear reactions going, and the protostar becomes a star. Meanwhile, in the outer regions of the original cloud are formed subsidiary centers of much smaller accumulations, and these form the planets and their satellites. Theories of this type haven't had all the bugs ironed out of them either, but they're leading the pack at the moment. The creation by gradual accumulation hypothesis, however, need not imply the existence of a liquid Earth ever in its history. Solid particles getting together can conceivably simply form a solid planet. To form a liquid planet out of solid particles requires a source of heat, and a large one. The primitive sun as a source of heat is not likely. It isn't hot enough to melt Earth now, fortunately, and it was undoubtedly cooler in these early days. The kinetic energy of particles falling together to form the solid Earth would be converted to heat, and I suppose this is a possible source of the heat. Certainly that is enough to heat the sun to the thermonuclear kindling point. However, the Earth is a minute mass in comparison to the Sun. There is far less kinetic energy involved in Earth's formation than in the Sun's, and we ought to look further. Fortunately, there is one other massive source of energy available, radioactivity. As the Earth is formed, its accumulating matter would trap a certain number of radioactive atoms. A number of these radioactive atoms would be breaking down at any given moment. Each atom, as it broke down, would liberate an amount of energy many billions of times greater than that represented by the kinetic energy with which it struck the growing Earth in the first place. In fact, the internal heat of the Earth today almost certainly originates from the breakdown of radioactive atoms that make up part of its structure today, so we may have something. But certainly Earth's radioactivity isn't enough to liquefy it, not today anyway. Earth isn't liquid now, and definitely hasn't been for at least 3.5 billion years into the past. Why, then, should radioactivity have liquefied it in the beginning? Or, if somehow radioactivity did do that, why isn't Earth still liquid? Why has it solidified? Let's see. And so, he then goes into a calculation, essentially, to show by what degree the release of heat from radioactive decay was greater 4 billion years ago than it is now. You know, how much, in an average mass of the composition of the Earth, how much radioactivity there is now, and how much greater it was then. It's a very interesting calculation. Very clever. Also in this issue is P. Schuyler Miller's book review column, in which he starts out talking about the problem of fallout from nuclear weapons. And I might go back and read that. And then there's one of John W. Campbell's famous editorials. Campbell has become more controversial. You know, for many, he's a bit like Edison in that for a long time he was just lionized, and then more recently has become greatly criticized. And in all cases, I'm prepared to say that there's some exaggeration on all sides. But certainly no one can deny that his editorials are often fascinating and valuable reading. Even if you disagree completely with what he has to say, they force you to reformulate your own position. So I may come back to that. But actually what I wanted to read, you know, because the thing is that these articles in many cases are written by people working in the field, and they give their understanding of their field at the time, or some aspect of it that they find extremely, extremely useful, or interesting, or important. And so that's, so I want to read for you, actually. Now, there's a there's a marvelous, this 1953 December has a marvelous piece by Asimov, which is it's a sequel to his infamous piece, the endochronic, final report on the endochronic properties of resublimated thiotumulene, which was submitted, it was published just before his actual doctoral dissertation, and the panel he was defending his dissertation to actually forced him to answer a question about it. But yes, yeah, so there's actually a second, a companion piece to that, the micropsychiatric applications of thiotumulene. In other words, microdosing, but with a compound that causes actual time travel. So be careful of that. But what I actually want to read for you right now is a piece of enormous interest, of enormous scientific interest, enormous interest perhaps in the history of society, of science. Anyway, astronomy? I'm a little incoherent, I think, at the moment. I haven't been sleeping well, I guess. But, yes, so the title here is The Mystery of the Blue Mist of Mars by R.S. Richardson. Richardson was an astronomer. He was, among other things, one of the first people to discuss the possibility of a space telescope. And in older science fiction, you'll find that the observatory on the moon is inevitably named after Richardson. But he was a frequent contributor to Astounding. So if you want to know why there's so much interest in planetary science and Mars, this article will help you to understand, I think. Because remember, Richardson is writing before the beginning of the space age. To most people, blue mist means the dark, depressing cloud which envelops us when we wake up Monday morning. But to an astronomer, the words have quite a different significance, especially if the astronomer happens to be a planetary man. For to a planetary man, blue mist means only one thing, the mysterious haze or veil which prevents us from seeing the surface of Mars in blue or violet light. Today, the blue mist is pushing the canals hard for top place on the list of things we would like to know about Mars. One reason in particular why we would like to know more about the blue mist is that it can give us information on the biggest question of all, the question of life on Mars itself. While the discovery of the canals is now 3/4 of a century old, the blue mist is a comparative newcomer among Martian phenomena. It has long been known that the appearance of Mars is quite different in light of different colors. This fact seems to have been first recognized by a Russian named Tikhov about 40 years ago, who photographed the planet in green, orange, and red light. He found that the familiar surface markings showed distinctly in red and orange light, but were barely discernible in green, which led him to predict that they would be missing entirely in blue and violet. This prediction has been abundantly confirmed by later work. In blue and violet light, the disk of Mars is blank, except for the polar cap, which appears even more conspicuous than on the red photographs, a circumstance that does not appear to have been foreseen by anyone. These results might have been predicted with considerable confidence without taking any photographs at all. We know that longer wavelength red light is more penetrating than blue, or, putting it the other way around, the shorter wavelength blue light is scattered more by air molecules than red. Every camera fan who likes to experiment with different emulsions and color filters is well aware of this effect. Thus, a distant mountain which stands out sharp and clear when snapped in red light may not show at all when photographed through a blue filter. The blue images almost invariably appear dim and washed out compared with those taken in red. Therefore, when applied to Mars, we would expect red light to penetrate the planet's atmosphere and show us the surface markings, while blue light would show only the outer atmospheric veil. In this case, the observations are in exact agreement with theory. But Venus was a surprise, for it will be remembered that the surface markings show only in violet light on that planet. Evidently, the atmosphere of Mars is similar to ours in that it serves as a good shield against the ultraviolet radiation from the sun. At the surface of the Earth, our atmosphere stops all ultraviolet light shorter than wavelength 2900 angstroms. The constituent that is most effective in this respect is ozone at an altitude of about 12 miles, although it also occurs considerably higher. If brought to sea level, the ozonosphere would form a shifting, unstable layer of molecules, O3, scarcely a tenth of an inch in thickness. Yet this is all that protects us from a flood of ultraviolet radiation that might blind and even eventually kill us if the Earth were exposed to it for long. It is often considered as providential that the Earth has an ozone layer, but of course this is arguing the wrong way around. If the ozone layer were not there, we would doubtless have become highly resistant to ultraviolet light by this time. Now, we know very little about the atmosphere of Mars. In fact, practically all our knowledge on the subject is negative in character. We can only tell what we don't know. But according to the latest expert opinion on the subject, the atmosphere of Mars consists of the following by volume: 95.5% nitrogen, 1.2% argon, 0.25% carbon dioxide, oxygen, water vapor, and other gases less than 0.05%. I would like to know how they got the decimal points on the figures. If there is no oxygen on Mars, then there can be no ozone layer. It is true that, if there was a little oxygen present long ago, the ozone layer would have been formed near the surface instead of several miles up. The reddish tint of the desert has been ascribed to iron oxides due to such a chemically active gas. The idea is less attractive now than when first advanced 18 years ago, since observations made in 1948 revealed that the red deserts do not reflect like iron oxides. This has ruined several dramatic accounts of how death came to the red planet, with its picture of the Martians fighting a losing battle with their dwindling supply of oxygen. A few managed to survive by taking cover under glass domes like inverted casserole dishes. But the most recent work indicates that the desert may consist of a hydrated ferrous oxide called limonite. More observations will be needed to settle the matter. Whilst stories and articles about Mars continue to warn of the dangers of exposure to ultraviolet radiation, actually, the Martians would seem to be pretty well fixed in this respect. If they cannot boast of an ozonosphere, they can still point with pride to their blue mist, but with this difference. While the amount of ozone in our atmosphere varies during the year, there is always plenty on hand to stop the ultraviolet light cold. But on Mars, something can happen on rare occasions that clears out the blue mist to an astonishing degree. The most remarkable instance on record occurred on the nights of May 20th and 21st, 1937. Ordinarily, the blue mist is so thick that even such intense markings as the Syrtis Major are invisible on photographs taken in blue and violet light. On these nights, however, the Lowell Observatory reported that the Syrtis Major appeared on blue photographs so distinctly that one might easily have supposed they were the ordinary yellow images of the planet. It might be objected that perhaps the change was not in the atmosphere, but in the dark markings themselves. But this could not have been the case, since photographs taken on the same nights in yellow and red light showed the markings as usual. Also, the change was not planet-wide, but was restricted to an area extending over roughly 10% of the surface, centered about the Syrtis Major, and including parts of the Mare Erythraeum and Sabaeus Sinus, as well as a portion of the Thoth Nepenthes and Nilo-Syrtis canal systems. Other markings nearby did not appear in blue light, as usual. There seems no escape from the conclusion that the change was caused by some extraordinary meteorological phenomenon which produced the temporary clearing observed. The nature of the blue mist is still a matter of speculation. Obviously, it is not a permanent constituent of the planet's atmosphere. The most likely material would seem to be fine dust particles, or tiny crystals of ice, or frozen carbon dioxide gas. We could tell much better if we knew something about the height of the blue mist. The suggestion that the haze consists of ice particles receives some support from the sun dogs and solar halos seen in our own atmosphere on cold, clear days. Now, how can the blue mist give us any information about life on Mars? The best evidence, indeed, the only evidence that there is life anywhere in the universe besides the Earth, is found in the seasonal changes of the dark markings of Mars. After the polar cap begins to melt in the spring, the dark markings in that hemisphere grow in size and turn a deeper shade of green. In the autumn and winter, the markings are much fainter. While these changes strongly suggest the growth and decay of vegetation, the case is by no means proved. An alternative hypothesis is that the dark markings are covered by alkali salts, which absorb water from the evaporating polar cap, an idea that was put forth about 35 years ago by the Swedish chemist and Nobel Prize winner Svante Arrhenius. In view of the fact that there is probably not enough water on the whole of Mars to fill the Great Lakes, the hygroscopic salt theory seems rather far-fetched, yet it continues to turn up with monotonous regularity year after year. Let us consider the following chain of reasoning. Large organic molecules are destroyed by ultraviolet radiation. The blue haze shields the surface of Mars from ultraviolet radiation. Therefore, if there is plant life on Mars, it will not have developed resistance to ultraviolet radiation. On rare occasions, the blue haze clears away, allowing ultraviolet radiation to reach the surface. The damaging effect of excessive exposure to ultraviolet radiation may produce detectable changes in the color of the dark markings. Hence, If measures show a definite change in the tint of the dark markings during a period of blue clearing, it would be favorable to the vegetative hypothesis. Such measures were made recently by Seymour L. Hess, a meteorologist, using photographs taken at the Lowell Observatory when Mars was within 39 million miles in 1939 and 1941. His measures were made on the intensity of the Syrtis Minor relative to the desert region surrounding it, which was presumed to have remained constant. In October 1941, there was a period of blue clearing which lasted for 10 days. The Martian season at the Syrtis Minor corresponded roughly to that of late summer in Australia. The measures showed that during the normal blue haziness, the Syrtis Minor was fading or becoming browner in color, but that the trend was halted during the clear period. Hess interprets this as indicating a normal seasonal color variation before and after clearing, which was interrupted by the injurious effects of the nearly full-strength ultraviolet radiation. Thus, the 1941 observations favor the hypothesis that there is vegetation on Mars and that the blue haze is an important factor in protecting the growth. In 1939, the photographs of Mars taken at the Lowell Observatory showed no clearing of the blue haze, and the changes in tone of the Syrtis Minor seemed to correspond to the natural seasonal variations. Unfortunately, there are gaps in the record, so that the blue haze might have cleared away for a few nights and never been noticed. An astronomer at another observatory reported that his photographs of Mars in 1939 show some evidence of clearing. Thus, the results for that year are inconclusive. This is a highly ingenious method of extracting information on an exceedingly difficult subject, and further results will be awaited with much interest. Mars was close enough in May 1952 for some work to be done. There will be a still closer approach in June 1954, and a very close approach of 35 million miles in September 1956. The planets are the most neglected bodies in the sky, but there is probably more interest in them at present than at any time during the last 25 years. Credit for this wave of enthusiasm sweeping the astronomical profession is due largely to Dr. Gerald Kuiper of the Yerkes McDonald Observatories, who has almost single-handedly shown that there are still possibilities for discovery in this field. If projects now underway at several large observatories turn out successfully, we should know much more about the blue mist by the end of 1956 than at present. In any case, think what a fine subject it would make for a story of famine on Mars caused by villains from the Earth seeding the atmosphere of the planet. Now, I'm also going to read here just a bit from P. Schuyler Miller's column, The Reference Library, which is book reviews. But the thing is, he always reviews science fiction and science fiction-related books, but he often starts with something of more general interest to people who might read and write science fiction. And he starts off with a piece entitled, One World. One of the basic tenets of science fiction is that we will eventually have a one Earth, or one system, or one galaxy culture encompassing all languages, races, and even species. By the same token, now seeming to spill even into serious nonfiction, he puts that in quotes, naturally, there is the lost race or lost civilization theme, which holds that we have backslid from some such planetary culture which existed in the remote past. This resurgence of a science fiction theme in a series of books presented for serious consideration is worth some discussion. Now, I will say that modern science fiction is much less likely to embrace that tenet, possibly due to the among other things, the greater influence of anthropologists, people like Ursula K. Le Guin, of course, whose father was Kroeber, the well-known anthropologist. A generation ago, the late Colonel P.H. Fawcett had made himself the personification of the romantic British explorer who believed in wonders beyond the ranges. Lost Trails, Lost Cities, Funk and Wagnalls, New York, 1953, 332 pages, $5, his incompleted memoirs, has been published now, 27 years after his disappearance, by his son, Brian Fawcett. Fawcett's basic belief was that the hinterland of Brazil held the remains of a high civilization, higher than those of Peru and Middle America, and presumably of great age. In America's Ancient Civilizations, Putnam, 1953, 334 pages, $5, A. Hyatt Verrill and his wife Ruth credit the Sumerians with being the founders of the high civilizations, not only of the Americas, but of the entire world. Harold Wilkins, in his Mysteries of Ancient South America, Roy Publishers, New York, 1952, 216 pages, $4, cuts across both books with a completely uninhibited proof that the Brazilian cities, as well as the pre-Incas and others, were colonies, or perhaps even the motherland, of Atlantis, and date back 10 to 20,000 years. Finally, in quite a different category, there is Thor Heyerdahl's imposing compendium of parallels between America and Polynesia, the background for his Kon-Tiki expedition, American Indians in the Pacific, Rand McNally, New York, 1953, 821 plus 15 pages, $15. The American edition seems to be printed from the Swedish plates and costs less than the English and Canadian editions. If you come to the Fawcett book, as I did, expecting a long account of the author's more exotic ideas about a lost Brazilian civilization, you will be disappointed. Instead, you have an amazing travel book, the experiences of a young artillery officer who came to South America in 1906 to referee the boundary dispute among Peru, Bolivia, and Brazil, and who, to all intents and purposes, never went home. He shows you a picture of human brutality at its worst, in an era when Indians were considered less than animals, when life in the deep jungle went on as it must have done for centuries. Other reviewers have called Lost Trails, Lost Cities one of the great personal narratives of our time. It closes, of course, before 1926, when Colonel Fawcett, his son, and a friend vanished into the Mato Grosso in search of City Z, and very little of Fawcett's ideas about the supposed Brazilian cities appears. Obviously, he was saving that until he had evidence to show for his beliefs. The impression of honesty and sincerity comes through clearly. Of course, there is Fawcett's story of the 62-foot anaconda he killed on the Rio Negro. Raymond Dittmars, the top reptile man, allows only slightly over 20 feet as the maximum, based, however, on zoo specimens. There is his double-nosed Andean tiger hound, of which he says, the two noses as cleanly divided as though cut with a knife. I suppose Indians, given such a freak mutation, might breed it, on the theory that two noses are better than one for scenting jaguars. And there is his story of the little black statue, a gift of Rider Haggard, which a psychometrist linked with Atlantis. But you will find that Fawcett makes a clear distinction between what he saw himself and what he heard rumored, which is a great deal more than some of the Sunday supplement reporters who quoted him seem to have done. The story of the Brazilian cities seems to originate with a nameless Portuguese adventurer who in 1753 went gold hunting in the Brazilian backcountry west of Bahia and the Rio São Francisco. Wilkins, by the way, quotes his account in full. The story, written to please the current politicos, and hence quite possibly pure fiction, was pigeonholed until 1841. It seems still to exist. Both Fawcett and Wilkins cite other attempts and reputed successes as recent as 1913 to find the Brazilian cities. And in his last chapters, Fawcett hints that he did see something. I doubted for a time the existence of the old cities, and then came the sight of remains that proved the truth of at least part of the accounts. What remains? He never says. That was to be the story he would write after he came out of the Mato Grosso, for the project on which he vanished was to penetrate the region from behind, from the south, reaching the Amazon drainage where his trail vanished, then driving east through the territory of the mysterious Sierra Roncador to City Z, eventually coming out on the San Francisco, where the chronicler of 1753 had gone in. It was a tough order for a man of 59, alone with two young greenhorns, but if anyone could have made it in 1926, Fawcett could. He didn't. But why do I ramble on like this? Surely, if there are lost cities and a lost high culture in the Brazilian plateau, similar to those elsewhere in the highlands of ancient America, the archaeologist will have described them. And if it's all hogwash and moonshine, the professors will tell you what is there. Only, they don't. They say nothing at all about the region. There may be accounts, plenty of them, in Brazilian journals. If so, neither Fawcett in 1926 nor Wilkins in 1952 mentions them in support. And the most recent and complete overview of the past and present Indian cultures of all South America, the Bureau of American Ethnology's six-volume Handbook of South American Indians, treats the Brazilian uplands as if they don't exist. I don't make of this a scientific conspiracy to conceal what is common knowledge, but embarrassing to orthodox theories. I do see an admission of out-and-out ignorance of the entire region, past and present. And what better place to lose a lost civilization than in such a hole in the map? Followers of Fawcett can indeed find some crumbs of comfort in the handbook. There is a zone of high ceramic development in pre-Columbian times at the mouth of the Amazon and along various of its lower tributaries, whose relations to and connections with the other centers of culture are unknown. The nearest place where rumor places high cultures is in the Brazilian highlands, where City Z is supposed to be. Geographically, this region is almost continuous with the highlands in Bolivia and Peru, where high cultures did rise. So far from being trackless and impassable is the region between that in the late 15th century, Guarani Indians from the Mato Grosso raided the eastern Inca frontier. And in 1540, the Tupinamba en masse left the coast of Brazil in search of a legendary land of immortality and showed up 9 years later in Peru. True, repeated flights have been made over the region where the lost Sierra Roncador and its cities are supposed to be during and after the war, and no mountains are there. But both the handbook and Fawcett's accounts show that the area is a dissected tableland. Mountains from below going up, but flat as a pancake from the air. Conan Doyle, by the way, based the Lost World on Fawcett's account of these Mato Grosso mesas, not on the Guyanas. Now that is an interesting piece of news. I always associated it with Roraima, but I think maybe that was the filmmakers responsible for that. What sanity and calmness there is in Colonel Fawcett's account is certainly lacking in the Wilkins book. Mysteries of Ancient South America is a work of the class which puts the revelations of Madame Blavatsky on a par with the chronicles of the conquistadores and the finds of usually 19th century diggers. Hubert Wilkins, the great explorer, who once attempted to rent a submarine from the United States Navy, the old Nautilus, the 1930s Nautilus, before the introduction of nuclear power, with the idea that he was going to affix skis to the top of it and ski along on the underside of the polar ice, which is not flat enough to ski on the top surface, much less the bottom. As the later nuclear-powered Nautilus determined, the underside of the Arctic ice cap is, in fact, very irregular. So, Hubert Wilkins, being an enthusiast for something unlikely and unhelpful, isn't that surprising? The world in which the author believes, and it is in some respects the picture Fawcett held too, is an America in which high cultures existed before Atlantis, when a sea filled the Amazon basin and cut up South America into highland islands, each with its own great civilization. On Brazil, a lost white race built strange cities lit with globes of never-dying fire 25,000 years ago. Over in the Andes, another civilization centered around an allegedly 13,000-year-old Tiahuanaco, which had been raised from sea level when the Andes were built, Orthodoxly, this event happened at the end of the Cretaceous some 60 million years ago, but I suspect Mr. Wilkins would maintain quite happily that Tiahuanaco was there at the time. With the collapse of Atlantis, the rising of the Andes and the Amazon, black-robed missionaries from the old cities set out to educate the shattered peoples of the world and restore civilization. It is the exasperating and discouraging feature of such books as this that fact is so inextricably mixed and muddled with rumor, misstatement, conjecture, and out-and-out fiction that anything thought-provoking is completely lost in nonsense. Wilkins does reprint a translation of the Portuguese manuscript of 1753 and quotes lavishly from other contemporary, if often unidentified, chroniclers. He offers an 8-page bibliography. It would, of course, take years to check his references. But he attributes the statements to Fawcett, which the latter certainly didn't put into his own book, and makes flat statements about inscriptions all over the New World which are allegedly identical with those in Asia and Africa. From Madame Blavatsky and her theosophists, he gets occult confirmation for a system of colossal treasure-crammed tunnels underlying the Andes from Ecuador into Chile. Books such as this completely discredit any possible factual hints to be derived from the explorations of Fawcett and other lost city hunters. Since no one seems to have looked, there is no fundamental reason why this part of Brazil could not have held a high pre-Columbian culture, perhaps in view of the Guarani and Tupinamba treks, which Orthodox anthropology accepts as actual, as an outlier of the Andean region. Unknown cultures have turned up in Panama and Mexico in the last 20 years, and there are certainly more to come. I'd say not proven. Okay. So that's a good piece. I have to say that's a very good piece. I thought, let's see, shall I read a Campbell editorial from December 1957, in which, as often happens, he muses on the nature of science. And Campbell had an interesting habit of supporting quackery. In other words, he thought that many scientific discoveries of great value are made by people who are completely nuts, who have some weird theory that doesn't belong in science, but because of their weird theory, they go out and actually discover something valuable. Let's see. Well, what is it? Yeah, sure. All right. Let's try this. December 1957, yes. Demonstration Part 1. To a mathematician, to demonstrate means to produce a valid sequence of mathematical logic, yielding as a conclusion the proposition being demonstrated, quod erat demonstrandum in the classical phrase. The development of physical science as an intellectual discipline has brought in the concept of demonstration, which has to do with a physical action display. But the question I'd like to bring up is, precisely what relationship does it have to physical action display? Precisely what does a demonstration mean in modern science? The thing that makes it tricky is that logic, which is our principal formal tool of intellectual communication, is not in one-to-one correspondence with physical reality. Mathematical demonstration can be fully defined. Logic in the full formal sense works only when all the relevant data are available. In mathematics, the logician is working in a universe of discourse. That universe contains all the characteristics he assigns it, and none that he has not assigned it. It has no unsuspected characteristics, however many hitherto unrecognized deductions may be possible. A mathematical problem in X, Y, and Z, for instance, can never have an unsuspected W acting on the equations, so that the X, Y, and Z system won't balance. But when physicists tried calculating atomic behavior in terms of electrons and protons, their mathematical equations might balance perfectly, but the real atoms didn't match so good. There were unsuspected neutrons, neutrinos, positrons, and other factors unbalancing the system. Mathematical demonstrations can be clear, clean, and definitive. They work in a universe defined in full by the mathematician. Physical science finds mathematics enormously helpful, but demonstration in physical science involves something other than the neat, clean, and complete mathematical logic demonstration. Fine. But what does it involve precisely? What does constitute a demonstration? Part of the problem of defining it is that we can't define meaning. Every human being has a conviction that the term meaning has a reality referent, but no one yet has been able to define that referent. Facts are not a demonstration, because demonstration involves a clear communication of meaning of the facts, which gets difficult when meaning itself can't be defined. For example, I can give a photographic demonstration of a fact that I can hang unsupported in midair. The photograph will be a completely honest, unretouched photograph of perfect clarity. It involves no montage work or anything of the sort, no concealed wires or anything else. It can be done with a three-axis photographic setup, showing the demonstration from a three viewpoints at the same instant. All I need is a properly equipped, modern, professional photographic studio with an adequate bank of 1/100,000th-second electronic flash lamps. Now, this would be a true, valid, genuine demonstration of the fact that I can hang unsupported in midair. That would be precisely what I would in fact do. The only problem here is the definition, the meaning of the term hang. Long ago, H.G. Wells in his Time Machine story brought up the question of whether an instantaneous cube existed. If something exists for less than 1/10 trillionth of a second, can it be said to exist? Recent studies indicate that the energy production in some of the older and more brilliant stars comes from helium thermonuclear reactions, which depend on a chain of reactions going through the beryllium isotope, beryllium-8. But beryllium-8 has a half-life of about 10^-15 power seconds, about 1/4 trillionth of a second. Something which exists for so short a time doesn't really exist within the meaning of exist, does it? By the time a star's core reaches the densities and temperatures involved in these helium thermonuclear reactions, interparticle collisions occur so fast that even 10^-15 power seconds becomes an appreciable period. There's another tough problem. Suppose a man has a wonderful new theory of how the phenomenon of framstrahlung takes place. He is convinced that it happens because of process zeta. So he sets out to prove his theory by finding data to fit his theory. He even tortures normal phenomena into wild and wonderful improbabilities to force the data he needs to appear. Now, is this weird setup he arranges to be called cooking the data to fit the theory or performing a crucial experiment? Lord Rutherford claimed that the elements could be transmuted by the action of radioactivity radiations. By the use of a weird contraption involving a rubber bulb, an inverted Erlenmeyer flask nearly filled with India ink-stained water, and a little radium, he got some photographs of some cloudiness which he claimed showed transmutation was possible. Was this cooking the data to fit a theory, or a crucial experiment? All he actually demonstrated was that water vapor will condense to form fog when a saturated volume of vapor in air is suddenly expanded. Furthermore, he couldn't demonstrate the phenomenon on demand. He had only a few pictures that he claimed were proof of his theory. Current nuclear research work being done with the Bevatron in California cannot be duplicated in other laboratories elsewhere. There's only one Bevatron. Are these experiments repeatable experiments, then? What does the term mean? Some recent studies on the mechanism of corrosion inhibitors led to a theory that the size of the ion of the inhibitor had a lot to do with it. In order to demonstrate their theory, however, the researchers had to cook up something to prove their point. They synthesized their data-yielding material, since nothing in nature confirmed their idea. They made up of a corrosion-inhibiting solution of technetium, which doesn't exist in nature and had to be synthesized in a nuclear reactor. During the Second World War, when radar was first being used, it proved remarkably peculiar in its behavior. It did things that everybody knew were impossible. Microwave radar can't reach from the Caribbean to the Portuguese coast, but it did every now and then, to the confusion of all concerned. The inverse square law could readily show that Marconi's signals couldn't be picked up across the Atlantic. And anybody who knew anything about electromagnetic radiation would know that the curvature of the Earth would completely block signals from England to America. Ionosphere reflection wasn't so well known in those days. It was the radio amateurs who discovered some of the wild and unpredictable phenomena of very high-frequency radio propagation, things like ion clouds in the upper stratosphere and radio reflection from the ionized trails left by meteors. The concept demonstration becomes extremely difficult to handle in these areas. The hams, who first started getting radio contact at the very high frequencies over impossible distances, such frequencies aren't reflected by the ionosphere and are normally limited to line of sight, didn't have any explanation for the phenomenon. It just happened that Bill in New York contacted Bob in Chicago on a frequency band that couldn't possibly do it and carried on an exchange of information sufficient to allow them to identify each other and to confirm the contact by mail. They would have been utterly unable to demonstrate the phenomenon on demand before competent witnesses. They didn't have any theory of how such a thing could happen. It just did. The amateurs who first used the phenomenon didn't have the background in cosmology, astrophysics, meteorology, physics of the gaseous state, and a few other needed disciplines to explain what happened, but they were believed by the professionals sufficiently to have professional scientists start looking into the phenomenon, and answers began to emerge. It's called sporadic E-skip now, and brother, it's really sporadic, too. Anyone wanting a demonstration of the phenomenon had better get his own ham station, spend lots of time listening, and wait patiently till God, in his own good right time, causes it to happen. The right part of the sunspot cycle helps too, so you might have to wait half a dozen years. The essential difficulty is this: a demonstration must be believable, and belief is a subjective phenomenon tied to orientation, opinion, previous experiences, and whatnot. Orientation is the term for what we have. Superstition is the equivalent term for what they have. The term impossible is one that is normally defined strictly by negation of possible, which is defined largely in terms of negation of impossible. I propose that impossible refers to a relationship between a specific action or process and a specified or implied method of achievement, and that it has no meaning outside of that relationship. That part is italicized. It is impossible to trisect any given angle by the methods of Greek geometry. That is a provable fact, and it will forever be impossible. It is impossible to transmute the elements by any chemical process, and it will forever be impossible by definition of chemical process. You may refine uranium chemically, refine graphite chemically, and set up a reactor employing chemicals, but the transmutation of elements that results isn't a chemical process. It's nuclear. It has been proven that a bumblebee can't fly. It's aerodynamically impossible. It is, was, and always will be, and the proof is perfectly valid in terms of static winged flight. Lock the blades of a helicopter so they can't turn, and it can't fly either. It would drop like a stone. A piece of metal which is non-magnetic cannot distinguish one direction from another unless it's rotating rapidly. The properties of a dynamic system cannot be defined in terms of a static system. Now, at any time in the development of knowledge, there are two levels of research and discovery possible, the intensive and the extensive. Discovery can always be made on the basis of a more detailed examination of the already known. Logical deduction is of that order. Given a system of postulates and their generated conclusions, an infinite structure of deductions is possible. The number of propositions possible in plane geometry alone, for instance, is essentially infinite, using the old Euclidean postulates. Deductive exploration and research is an unlimited field, but not all the field of possibility. No possible extension of plane geometry can discuss the characteristics of a sphere. The extensive research must be non-deductive. It adds new levels, new dimensions to be researched. Where deductive research involves intensive development of the known, the intuitive, inductive, or whatever you wish to call it research, involves extensive development into the unknown. Of the two types, intensive research is by far the easiest. When you have achieved a result, you can communicate it readily and clearly, because it lies within the already known coordinates of the field. Your discovery is an hitherto unrealized implication of the known processes. You haven't discovered a phenomenon dependent on new laws, but on new applications of old laws. It is, in consequence, quickly and clearly communicable in standard terminology. However, when you discover a phenomenon based on no known law, you're in for a tough fight. If the phenomenon is as defined, a valid phenomenon which is based on no known law, but on some still undiscovered law, it will ordinarily yield two general sets of physical action results. One group will be actions which are duplicable by known processes, and a second group will involve actions that cannot be duplicated by known processes. For example, uranium fission produces heat, which is a well and long-known phenomenon, duplicable by long-known processes, and, in addition, produces nuclear phenomena which are not duplicable by any long-known process. Transmutation of elements, for example. The second group of phenomena will inevitably be impossible. They are actions which cannot be produced by any hitherto known method, since impossible describes a relationship between a specific action and a specific method. The second group of phenomena are by definition impossible. The essence of a crucial experiment is that an action is produced which is impossible by known methods. Thus, the proof of discovery that a new law exists is to produce an impossible result. Notice carefully, however, that the proof that a new law exists is not the same as proving a new law. The old alchemists had theories about elements, air, earth, fire, and water. Their experiments proved that laws of chemistry existed, but they definitely hadn't discovered what the laws were. The characteristic of a major breakthrough in human knowledge can be expected to present the following picture, then. 1. Someone demonstrates an action which is impossible. Associated with it will be a number of not impossible actions which can be reproduced by ordinary methods. These will serve to confuse the issue. 2. The demonstration of the phenomena will be highly erratic and unreliable. 3. The probability is about 0.99 that the discoverer presents an explanation that is a wild guess and a poor one at that. 4. The probability is about 0.9 that the discoverer will be an amateur who stumbled on it by accident. Professionals don't have accidents very often. They know their business too well. When they do have accidents, they take pains to eliminate the wild variable so that they can get on with their business. Amateurs, having no business to get on with, will start playing with the wild variable. 5. The first communication of the phenomenon, then, will be from an unknown amateur who doesn't know how to present his ideas in formal clarity and probably has the wrong idea anyway. The probability of the early demonstrations being erratic, unreliable, and unconvincing stems from the simple proposition that if you don't know what you're doing, you're likely to do it wrong. The first stages of the study of a truly new phenomenon ordinarily involve wild misconceptions as to what the cause-effect relationship in the new area should be. When the first work with batteries was done, there was great mystification that two quite small copper-zinc cells connected together could break down water electrolytically, while a huge cell with copper and zinc plates a yard square could not, yet the big cell could heat an iron wire red hot, while the two little ones couldn't. Concepts of volts and amperes, and the difference between them, were still years in the future. It made the behavior of electricity seem most weirdly arbitrary and improbable. It was so obviously irrational that two little cells could do what a big one couldn't. A barometer is a right handy instrument these days, but when the first mercury columns supported by air pressure were set up, it must have been slightly bewildering. One man's report on the height of the column must have seemed an unrepeatable experiment to other men. Imagine the argument a Tibetan monk, a Swiss scientist, and an Englishman might have gotten into. That, of course, has a hidden assumption contrary to fact that all three workers had a common and reliable unit of length. You can have fun, too, trying to define the meaning of the term obvious, as in the phrase, from this it is obvious that. Obvious usually turns out to mean, I can see a connection, and it is my opinion that anyone of reasonable intelligence will see the same connection. Any man who has sought to get his wife to explain the obvious connection she sees, or sought to explain something perfectly obvious to her, is aware that there are different methods of thinking approach to a problem.